start off by finishing up talking about two component spinners, and then get into talking about supersymmetry, what it is, and how you build Lagrangians that are symmetric under supersymmetry. So first of all, yesterday we spoke about 1/2 zero and 0/1/2 spinners. And we have various objects we can combine them into that transform in nice ways under Lorentz. And the simplest possible Lagrangian, the simplest non-trivial Lagrangian I can write for a 1/2 zero spinner is just a plain old kinetic term. So this thing alone is real. It gives a kinetic term for the spinner. To make something that's real, I need the conjugate spinner, psi bar, which we defined as taking the first thing over there on the very right-hand side. And okay, so this is a minimal theory. It's just a kinetic term. So it describes free particles. And in particular, the particles it corresponds to are a left-handed Weyl fermion, a massless left-handed Weyl fermion that goes along at the speed of light with its spin left-handed relative to its direction of motion. And that corresponds to this object. And then you have its conjugate particle, which corresponds to the antiparticle, which corresponds to a right-handed antifermion. So the interpretation of the massless case is that I have a massless fermion and antifermion pair, and they're always traveling at the speed of light. So I can add to this and still stay as a free theory if I just add a mass term. And the minimal mass term I can write down is consistent with Lorentz invariance, has this form. I have psi psi and psi bar psi bar. So this is just a complex conjugate of this. That's not very exciting. And now if you look at the equations of motion and you look at the dispersion relation, you see that this m corresponds to the mass of the corresponding the corresponding states. But now there's a bit of a difference. The difference now is that we have a massive particle instead of a massless particle. So with a massless particle, we interpret it as two states corresponding to a left-handed massless massless fermion and right-handed massless fermion antiparticle. In this case, the interpretation changes a bit. All we did was add a mass term, but the interpretation changes a bit. We still have two physical states. But now, given a state that starts off with a left-handed polarization, so a left-handed direction of spin in its direction of motion, we can do a Lorentz boost to the rest frame of that state, or even boost so that the state's going in the opposite direction. And that boost doesn't change the spin of the state. And what you get then is you can turn a left-handed state into a right-handed state by just doing a Lorentz boost. So in this case, we don't have this distinct notion of particle versus antiparticle. And the way we interpret this state now is that instead of having a distinct particle and antiparticle, you now just have one state that matches up with its antiparticle with two spin degrees of freedom. So you conserve the number of degrees of freedom, but the physical interpretation is a bit different. Now, going back to this, suppose we try to look for symmetries of the theory. So at this level, if I want to write down a continuous symmetry, this is essentially a complex valued object. The continuous symmetry would be something like a rephasing on psi. So this is sort of like the reasonable type of symmetry you try to put down. But obviously, if I just write down this term, it's not going to be symmetric. Or put another way, if I want my theory to be symmetric under global phase transformations, how shall I write this? So for some arbitrary phase psi, suppose I want my theory to be invariant under this. This forbids the mass term. So if I impose this symmetry on the theory, I'm not allowed to have mass terms, and I'm stuck with a massless case. Now, if I want to have a theory with this symmetry, but also with massive fermions, it turns out that I can't get that with just one Weyl fermion, but I can get that with two. So suppose I add a second Weyl fermion, and my second Weyl fermion I'll call it chi, and it's going to have its own kinetic term. And now if I want to write down a mass term, I can have a mass term consistent with this symmetry provided that chi transforms in this way. So in particular, if chi transforms oppositely to psi. So in this case, I forbid this kind of mass term, but I do allow a cross mass term of the form chi psi And then I need the conjugate piece too. So this is fine. I see that I now have some sort of mass term that is now, in terms of these fields, non-diagonal, whereas I have these diagonal kinetic terms. So from the outset, it's not necessarily obvious how to interpret this. But a nice way to deal with this is to change from two-component notation to four-component notation. So I argue that when you have a setup like this with this sort of built-in symmetry and these mixed mass terms, a natural way to deal with this and to essentially make this Lagrangian look diagonalized is to change to four-component fermions. So let me explain that in more detail. Specifically, let's define the four-component object psi to be made up of, my apologies, I just changed notation, but okay. So this is now a four-component object, where the upper two components correspond to the left-handed two-component object psi alpha, and the lower two components correspond to the different two-component object, or at least its conjugate, chi bar. So remember, in terms of massless states, this corresponds to a left-handed helicity, and this corresponds to a right-handed helicity. So this should start to, remind you of what you may have done with four-component objects, where we would call the upper and lower components of a four-component fermion psi left and psi right. So in terms of these two-component objects, we can form a four-component Dirac fermion with different two-component fermions in the upper and lower pieces. So we call this Dirac. And we can also define some nice stuff. Well, for one, if we take this and we conjugate this, this implies that chi dagger is just going to be it's just going to take this form. So all I've done is I've just flipped this and complex conjugated the components. And this is the relation. So when I take a star dagger of this, I change my alpha to alpha dot, and I get a bar there. And it corresponds to left-handed turning into right-handed with the funny index stuff. Now, the other thing I can define is a four-component, a 4x4 gamma mu matrix, which is convenient in this case to define as sigma mu, sigma bar mu, 0. And in terms of this, I can also define psi bar in the usual way as psi dagger gamma 0, which when I apply the gamma 0, it's just going to be 0, 0, 1, 1. And that means I flip the order of these things. And this just turns into a chi alpha psi bar alpha dot. So with these definitions, I can go back to my Lagrangian here and smooth it out a bit. So in particular, putting all this stuff together and collecting the bits, it turns out that my Lagrangian can be written in this form, which if you expand out the components of this thing in terms of these definitions, you get back the Lagrangian we started with. So you'll recognize this as just a standard Lagrangian for a free Dirac fermion. And this is how you go from two-component to four-component stuff. The four-component Dirac fermion actually has two different pieces, two different two-component Weyl fermion representations within it. So in this sense, the Dirac fermion is not an irreducible representation of Lorentz. It involves two irreducible representations of Lorentz glumped together. The reason it's useful, though, is that in terms of this object, our mass term, that in a two-component form looks to be off-diagonal, takes a nice diagonal form in this case. And it turns out that in terms of quantizing this, when your setup looks like this, it's easier to deal with. Having said that, though, this combination into these mass terms relies on the fact that the psi and the chi transform oppositely. Whereas if I think about the different components of the standard model fermions, without the Higgs, they don't have this opposite transformation law. And that means that without the Higgs, the standard model fermions don't combine nicely into Dirac fermions. And at least at high energies, where you don't care about the Higgs vacuum expectation value, you don't care about the masses, it turns out that the natural language for the standard model is in terms of these two-component objects. And we'll come back a little bit later on and talk about how to formulate the standard model entirely in terms of two-component fermions. Just one last component, though. One last comment, though. So this is a Dirac fermion. And specifically, the definition of Dirac is one that involves two different two-component spinners. I can also form what's called a Majorana fermion. And a Majorana fermion is what you would get if I used the complex conjugate of the upper component and the lower component. More generally, sometimes people also put an extra phase in here. But the really important thing is the lower component up to a phase is just a complex conjugate of the upper component. So if we go and count degrees of freedom in our Dirac fermion, we have two different two-component fermions. And our theory contains the fermion plus its antiparticle for each two-component fermion. So in terms of the Dirac state, we have four independent states. We have distinct particle-antiparticle pair, and each of those particle-antiparticle pairs has two spin states. Whereas in the Majorana case, there's only two degrees of freedom embedded in here, two distinct degrees of freedom embedded in here, and the typical interpretation for this is the particle and the particle is the same as its antiparticle, but it has two spin states. So Majorana fermions, they come up a lot in neutrino physics. And we'll actually see them in supersymmetry as well, are just in terms of two components things with these two pieces that are essentially the same thing, whereas the Dirac has different things. And specifically for Dirac fermions, the stuff inside it can have a net charge in this sense, whereas to write a mass term for a Majorana fermion, I can't have a net charge. And that corresponds to not having a distinct antiparticle. Okay, so that's all I want to say about two-component fermions, but I've got more notes about details of this, and there are lots of references for this. There's a whole 400-page review of two-component stuff. So there's lots of stuff out there to get more practice, but this is all we'll need to talk about supersymmetry for what we have in mind. Okay, so I'm going to change gears and now move on to supersymmetry. So yeah.
If you lump together two wild spinners into a Dirac spinner, and those are irreducible representations, and if you choose to call them particles or antiparticles or something of that sort, but those will always be massless, right? I mean, if you have two wild spinners, and if those are irreducible representations, and you choose to call one a particle, one the antiparticle, that will only give you massless.
Oh, yeah. So this Dirac grouping is useful specifically when you have an explicit mass term. So the whole motivation for this four-component Dirac fermion is to essentially diagonalize what looks like an off-diagonal mass. So if I don't have a mass term, the natural language to use is two-component vial spinners. But when I turn on this mass term, this chi psi, this mixes the two states. And the physical mass eigenstates are now all massive.
So you'll be mixing up the wild spinners in some sense, and then those will be called the electron and the positron.
Yeah. And actually, if you think about an electron mass term, if I expand out my standard electron mass term, this thing just turns out to be m e bar left e right plus e bar right e left. And you see explicitly the left-right mixing. Whereas if I don't have a mass term, then I can just think of the left and right-handed pieces independently. and there's no sense in which I can take a lap time to state and change its direction of motion by boosting. It's always going at the speed of light. Okay, so let me move on next to supersymmetry. Okay, so I think the history of the story is roughly sort of, I don't know, like mid-50s, mid-60s, people started getting interested in gauge theories. And people started getting interested in all kinds of different theories, and they saw Lorentz transformations and this and that. And there's a hope initially that maybe I could take some kind of gauge symmetry or some kind of global flavor symmetry or something and lump it in with space-time symmetries and get new kinds of objects and describe new kinds of physics. It turns out that that's more or less not possible. And what I mean by that is that if I want to take my Poincaré symmetry and extend it in some non-trivial way, let's say I try to extend it by tacking on a global symmetry that doesn't commute with the space-time symmetry, it turns out that this forces me to get essentially a trivial S matrix. So the S matrix is what describes particle scattering. And I obviously want theories where I have non-trivial scattering for the most part. And within this construction, it turns out that it's not possible to extend Poincaré up to one exception. And that one exception turns out to be supersymmetry. So supersymmetry took a while to find, because usually we're used to thinking of symmetries generated by objects that I'll describe as bosonic and objects that have commutation relations. Supersymmetry turns out to be a symmetry that's generated by fermionic objects in a sense that I'll show you in a minute. And it turns out that if you want your theory to have non-trivial scattering, a non-trivial S matrix, supersymmetry is the maximal way in which you can extend the Poincaré symmetries of spacetime. If you if you relax things a bit and you don't demand an S matrix, you don't demand scattering, you can also extend Poincaré by something called the conformal group. But the conformal group, rigidly defined, doesn't give you scattering. Anyway, so we're going to look at supersymmetry because we want particles that scatter, because that's what we see. And supersymmetry is a bit different from other symmetries you've seen in that the generators of supersymmetry, so I'll follow the convention and abbreviate supersymmetry as SUSY, are 1/2 0 and 0 1/2 fermion valued, or like Grassmann valued objects. So specifically, the set of generators of supersymmetry take the following form. I have a set of Qs and a set of conjugate Q bars. So this is a 1/2 0, this is a 0 1/2 fermion. And the A's and the B's go from 1 to some integer n, where n is said to be the number of supersymmetries. We're going to focus on the case where n is equal to 1, because it turns out that in 4 dimensions, n equals 1 is the only one that gives you representations of supersymmetry that have chiral fermions in it. But higher n representations of supersymmetry can also be interesting, but I won't touch on them much in this course at all. Okay, so in terms of these now fermion or Grassmann valued generators, instead of having commutation relations for them, we have anti-commutation relations. And specifically, the anti-commutation relations of a Q with a Q bar turn out to be 2 sigma mu alpha beta dot p mu delta AB. So because these things are now Grassmann valued, instead of talking about commutators, I talk about anti-commutators. If you think about quantum operators, when you say quantum operators anti-commute, the anti-commuting of quantum operators is a quantum effect, and the corresponding classical objects would commute. In the same way that instead of these objects commuting the classical limit, we want them to anti-commute in the classical limit because they're Grassmann valued. So that means that the natural thing instead of a commutator is an anti-commutator. In any case, we have this thing, and it anti-commutes into this piece. And we see that one of the Poincaré generators, in particular a space-time translation generator, appears as a result. So this means that if we think about the algebra for these generators, it's not independent of Poincaré symmetries. We see the Poincaré stuff generators coming up as a result. We also have that the Qs anti-commute with the Qs, and the Q bars all anti-commute with the Q bars. And finally, we can look at what happens when I combine the P mu with the Q alpha. And it turns out that these commute. OK, so this is the part of the supersymmetry algebra involving the translation generators. There's also a non-trivial connection of these Qs with the J-mu nus, the rest of the Lorentz generators, the rest of the generators of the Poincaré group. But those get into long, messy expressions that you look up in a book, and it's not useful for me to write them down. But in any case, it turns out that the commutes have non-trivial commutation relations with the J-mu nus. But when I take all this stuff together and compute all the commutators and anti-commutators, I find that they all close on themselves in the sense that if I start with the Qs, the Q bars, the J-mu nus, and the P-mus, and I compute all other commutators and anti-commutators as is appropriate, I don't need any other generators for the thing to close. So I have a closed so-called graded Lie algebra. So a graded Lie algebra means that I have both commutators and anti-commutators. The rules of the game are that if I have two fermionic objects, it's an anti-commutator. Otherwise, if I have two bosonic objects or one bosonic object, P in this case is a bosonic object, you use a commutator instead. So this is a generalization of Lie algebras to a system where I now have generators that are Grassmann valued. And OK, so there's a lot of formal mathematics behind this that's very interesting. But again, I don't want to get into this. We're just going to concentrate on this story. OK, so this is the general story. We're going to focus on n equals 1 and d equals 4. And the reason for this, as I said before, is it turns out that this is the only case, at least in four dimensions, that gives you Weyl fermion representations. And to describe the standard model, where we know we have chiral fermions, we want Weyl fermion representations. For a higher n, all the Weyl fermions get packaged into essentially Dirac fermions. OK, so here's my supersymmetry. There are a few other rules of the game, so let me just make a list of them. So the other rules of the game to get a consistent theory are any other gauge or global symmetries, or specifically their generators, so any other symmetry generators must commute with these supersymmetry generators.
So except for the boosts and the translations, right? Because they don't.
Yeah. Okay. So maybe I should put it any other. Yeah. So obviously the translations, the boosts don't. But for any other things, like a global flavor or global gauge or local gauge symmetry, those generators have to commute with the queues and the queues. Yes?
Are these relations by definition, or is there a way to see why we should have these commutation and elongation
relations? So you can see this as a definition of the supersymmetry algebra. I think that historically it is kind of a case of people fiddling until they found something that worked, more or less. It's a bit more directed than that, but okay. This turns out to be the thing that works, and it's not necessarily obvious where this comes from. But I claim that this works in a consistent way, and we more or less don't know of another way to do it that is consistent.
I mean, it's because, for example, if you have a Q and a Q bar, it's half zero and a zero half thing, and you can sort of argue that it should be a vector, or is it just definition? Nothing
about. Well, I mean, at this point, it's just a definition. But we saw earlier that if I have an alpha, if I have a 1/2 1/2, this should combine into a thing that has if I have a 1/2 0 and a 0 1/2, this combines into a 1/2 1/2. And yeah, this is one example of that coming out. So in some sense, the only thing that could come out of this is something that transforms like a vector. We see that. So again, this is all self-consistent, and there's basically more or less nothing else you could do that is self-consistent. It still gives an untrivial S matrix, and this is the result. So it shouldn't be obvious where this comes from, but it comes out, and at least I hope it should look fairly reasonable. Okay.
In case of Lorentz transformation, we know what is the physical meaning of the finite transformation of group. Mm-hmm. Translation, boost, rotation. How can I interpret QA and QB, like Q bar, in terms of?
Yeah. Well, so I'll come back to that when I talk about representations on fields. But the answer is going to be that the Q is going to turn a boson into a fermion, and a fermion into a boson. Okay. So these are my rules. The second rule, and you can show this by brute force. The P squared operator commutes so the p squared is p mu p mu, and we saw just for regular Lorentz that p squared commutes with everything. So p squared commutes with all the j mu nus, and it obviously commutes with all the p mus. P squared is also going to commute with everything here, which okay, I guess this arises fairly trivially, but okay, it's also true. And because p squared commutes with all the other generators, we can classify our supersymmetry representations by the p squared eigenvalue, just like we did with Lorentz transformations. And in particular, any given representation of supersymmetry this implies that if I have a representation for supersymmetry, where the different objects within the representation transform into each other under Lorentz transformations and under supersymmetry transformations, because p squared commutes with all those other generators, when I apply p squared to any state in this, I'm going to get some p squared eigenvalue, or I can choose my states to be p squared eigenvalues. But then if I go and I also apply a supersymmetry transformation to that, and then apply p squared again, I get the same eigenvalue, because p squared commutes with everything. So this means, as a result, that everything within a supersymmetry multiplet, which we're going to see will identify with particles, have to have the same mass. So this will also be useful, and it will also be a headache for constructing actual theories, but we'll come back to how to deal with that. I won't show this, but I won't show this explicitly. But it turns out that within any supersymmetric representation, the number of bosonic degrees of freedom has to be equal to the number of fermionic degrees of freedom. finally, the fourth thing is that if I have a theory that's a variant under supersymmetry, this should mean that my vacuum state should be annihilated by the supersymmetry Q alpha. So this is just like the condition for any other sort of a global symmetry to leave the vacuum invariant. When the generator doesn't leave the vacuum invariant, you see that you have spontaneous symmetry breaking. So with this fact, I can also combine and show that with my Q bar So suppose I apply my first anti-commutator, and suppose I apply this in the rest frame of my system. Or put another way, suppose I sandwich this between two vacuum states. If I sandwich this between two vacuum states, I'll also have things with vector p's, but the vector p annihilates the vacuum by construction. So the vacuum doesn't have any regular momentum, and I'm just left with this piece. Or alternatively, I can think of this as living in the rest frame. But the upshot of this is that this implies that for a theory of supersymmetry, I identify this with a Hamiltonian. And this implies that in a theory of supersymmetry, the Hamiltonian acting on the vacuum also vanishes as well. So in particular, for a theory of supersymmetry, in this form, because I can rewrite my Hamiltonian in terms of this kind of anti-commutator, you can show that in the theory of supersymmetry, the vacuum has to be annihilated by the Hamiltonian, and that forces you to have a zero vacuum energy. We'll see this in explicit examples down the road as well. Okay. So in general, we're going to see that supersymmetry acting on a boson state is going to be a fermion state. And supersymmetry acting on a fermion state will be a boson state. So I'll show this explicitly in a minute. But this is the general story of how things go.
What about the Pauli Lebesgue state? That's not conserved anymore, right? Because otherwise you would change the spin.
Or... So the Pauli Lebesgue coincides with essentially the JJ plus one of a representation. But now the Qs don't commute with that because I can have different spins within the multiple. So this is my story. Let's sit down and actually try to write down theories with built-in supersymmetry. So maybe I'll just go over here. Okay, so specifically, we want to look at representations of this supersymmetric algebra. And I'm not going to drive them explicitly, but I'm just going to tell you which ones end up being useful in four dimensions. And the first one is a so-called chiral multiplet that I'm going to denote by chi. And the chiral multiplet has as its components a complex scalar, a Weyl fermion, and a so-called auxiliary field. And this object is complex as well. So it turns out that this is a minimal non-trivial representation of supersymmetry. Under supersymmetry transformations, these things all transform into each other in a closed set. So these things just mix under supersymmetry transformations. And I want to write down an action for a chiral supermultiplet. And it turns out that the minimal action I can write down for a chiral supermultiplet is consistent with supersymmetry has the following form. Okay. So this piece is just a regular canonical kinetic term for a complex scalar. This is just a regular canonical kinetic term for a Val fermion, which necessarily includes its anti-state. And this F field doesn't have, I just have F dagger F here. I don't have any derivatives on it. So from this point of view, this thing has a kinetic term. This thing has a kinetic term. This thing doesn't have a kinetic term. And because this thing doesn't have a kinetic term, it's not going to correspond to a propagating degree of freedom. There's no sense in which it's going to be an active field. And this is why we call it an auxiliary field. In particular, we're going to ultimately integrate it out of our theory because it doesn't affect the dynamics directly. But in terms of how things transform under supersymmetry, it ends up simplifying the transformation rules. OK. Let me just take a quick step back. Under supersymmetry, what ends up happening to these objects is a supersymmetry transformation on phi is going to change phi by a little bit. And a small change in phi has a form. So I should say that a general supersymmetry transformation has a form I minus I psi q. So this is a supersymmetry generator, and this is a fermion valued transformation parameter. So this is kind of a generalization of what I would do for bosonic fermion, where I have some transformation parameter and some generator. Here, this is my supersymmetry generator, and this is my transformation parameter. But to make everything match up nicely, my transformation parameter has to be fermion valued. So this is a Grassmann valued transformation parameter. So in terms of this Grassmann valued transformation parameter, the change in my bosonic field should still be altogether a boson at the end of the day. But it turns out that it takes a form chi psi. So in other words, the change in my boson field, my del psi, changes into, here's a small transformation parameter, and this is the thing it transforms into. In the same way that if I was to look at this thing acting on, let's say some vector, this object would go to 1 minus I alpha A TA acting on the vector plus higher order stuff. And this is the thing I identify with the change in the vector del V. In the same way, this is the thing I identify schematically with a change in the scalar field. The scalar field changes into a small parameter times a fermion field. And this corresponds to the action of Q on the phi state. If I look at the action of of supersymmetry on the psi state, it turns out that this transforms into psi mu psi bar del mu psi. And if I look at the effect of the transformation on the F field, this turns out to be a total derivative of stuff. So what ends up happening when I apply a supersymmetric transformation to all this stuff, this piece turns into the same thing plus a little bit of this piece. This piece turns into a little bit of this plus a little bit of a little bit of this. But the stuff that's turning into a little bit of this always involves a total derivative. And because the stuff that's turning into a little bit of that stuff involves a total derivative, when I put it into the action, the total derivative just becomes a surface term that I get rid of, and I can ignore. So it's in this sense that as I step through, phi goes to psi. Psi goes to something with an f, but the f always gets a derivative. This f piece, because it always gets a derivative, ends up being invariant. Okay, so again, I'm being very schematic here. But I have references where you can look up the actual transformations and see how this works out. In any case, though, I now have a free theory. And I can look at the equations of motion. And the equations of motion are trivial. For phi, it's just this. For psi, it's just this. And specifically for the F term, my equation of motion is very trivial. It's just F equals to 0. But in any case, I see I have a massless complex scalar, a massless Val fermion, and this F term, in this case, just drops out, and I don't care about it. Yeah.
Are these again by this definition, or like you said, that they turn out to be this way as a result of something else?
So this is how the transformations work on this particular representation. So I'm actually building the representation takes work, so I'm just stating the result.
Okay.
So this here is a fairly uninteresting supersymmetric theory. But we can still check the rules we have over here and make sure they work. So first of all, the scalar mass and the fermion mass are both zero. So everything is trivially equal in mass. If I count the number of degrees of freedom, I can count it on shell or off shell. So off shell means before applying equations of motion. And off shell means that I have a complex number here and a complex number here. And so I have two complex numbers, and that's four real degrees of freedom. Whereas if I look at psi before I apply the equations of motion, has two components. And both of those components are complex. So that gives me four fermionic degrees of freedom. So I see that so-called off-shell, if I just count the number of stuff in these fields, I have four fermionic things here, two bosonic things here, two bosonic things here, and everything matches up. If I apply the equations of motion and look at the physical excitations, the counting works out as well. So specifically, for the complex scalar, I have a physical particle and antiparticle, the complex scalar. For the vial fermion, I have a physical left-handed fermion and right-handed antifermion. So I have two bosonic degrees of freedom, two fermionic degrees of freedom, and the F is just zero, so I don't have any degrees of freedom there. So so-called on-shell, after applying these equations of motion, I see the physical excitations also match up in terms of the numbers of degrees of freedom. I have two bosonic degrees of freedom, so-called on-shell, and two fermionic degrees of freedom on-shell, and everything matches up with our expectations. Okay. So the next thing I want to do is explain how to expand this to include non-trivial interactions. Because free field theories are a bit boring. So it'd be easy to spend all 3 weeks on supersymmetry, so I'm just going to state the result and not show you where it comes from, but it'll be enough for what we're going to do. But there are lots of places where it's derived in a very nice way. So the story for writing down interactions is that for d equals 4, n equals 1, we can all the relevant interactions for the chiral field can be derived from a so-called superpotential. So the superpotential is a formal function of phi. And specifically, we say that it's holomorphic. And what this means in this context specifically is that it only depends on phi and not any kind of complex, and not any sort of complexification of phi. So our chiral supermultiplet. Our chiral multiplet has complex objects in it, so you can imagine taking complex conjugates of those things. The rule for the superpotential, though, is that it's some formal function of the phis that is holomorphic in the sense it only depends on phis and it doesn't depend on any phi daggers. So I take this, and the rules of the game are that I start with my basic Lagrangian up here, and the superpotential dictates how to write down interactions that are consistent with supersymmetry. And specifically, the interaction Lagrangian that I get from a superpotential takes the following form. So I'm just going to, for now, do it as a function of a single superfield. So there are two pieces. The first is this means that I take my formal function of phi, the superpotential. I take two derivatives of it with respect to the argument phi, and then I'm going to get some. I'm going to be left with some new function of phi. And what I mean by this little phi here is that wherever I see a big phi superfield here, I replace that superfield by its complex scalar component, little phi. So in other words, I'll show you an explicit example of this. And then this thing is going to connect up with two fermions, psi psi. This thing connects the F term with one derivative of the superpotential, again evaluated on the scalar field. And finally, I add the Hermitian conjugate, the complex conjugate, to make everything real. OK, so if I take this interaction Lagrangian and I connect it with my original kinetic Lagrangian, my full action is going to be this plus the interaction Lagrangian. What I can do right off the bat is find the equation of motion for F. So since F doesn't have any kinetic terms, it doesn't have any propagating degrees of freedom, and its equation of motion is trivial, and I can formally integrate it out. So in particular, if I solve for the equation of motion for F now, actually specifically I'll solve for the equation of motion of F dagger, which corresponds to the variation of the action with respect to F, what I find is this is just going to be minus dw d phi evaluated on phi. Because what happens is when I vary the Lagrangian, where I vary the action, ds df, I'm going to pull down an F dagger from this first kinetic piece. And from this interaction piece, I'm going to pull down the dw d phi. So my equation of motion now for the F term field is going to be this. And then I have its complex conjugate for the F piece. Now, because F doesn't have any dynamics, it's completely ruled by its equation of motion. And I can take this solution and plug it back into my original action. And when I do this and plug it back in and take into account that I have pieces with F, dw, d phi, Hermitian conjugate, and F dagger F, this tells us what our full interaction Lagrangian is after getting rid of the F term. And specifically, it turns out that our full interacting Lagrangian after getting rid of the F term is going to be minus 1 half d2w d phi squared evaluated on phi psi psi plus Hermitian conjugate minus dw d phi evaluated on phi all squared. So this is what you get from integrating out the F terms and plugging back into the interaction Lagrangian plus the original F dagger F piece. So it turns out that in this case, for these chiral supermultiplets, when this is the whole story, this is the most general way to write down an interaction involving the components of the chiral supermultiplet that's consistent with supersymmetry. It comes about in terms of the superpotential. When I define a superpotential, I define the set of interactions. And in terms of the superpotential, these are the interactions that come out. So these pieces are going to involve, these pieces are going to give me either mass terms for the fermion or Yukawa couplings, because this thing is going to involve scalar fields. And this thing is going to give me a scalar potential, so something that only involves scalar fields. So to see how this goes in practice, let me just write down a very simple example of a superpotential. And this is the so-called Vestimino model. OK. So if I apply the dw d phi squared, my interaction Lagrangian is going to be minus dw d phi of this, where I replace the phis with the scalar components. So the first piece is going to give me an m phi. The second piece is going to give me a lambda over 2 phi squared. And I square the whole thing. And then I also have the fermion piece. And the fermion piece is going to give me a minus 1 half And then I have a second derivative. So the second derivative is going to give me two derivatives on this, which get rid of all the phis. And I get a factor of 2. I get a m psi psi. Actually, sorry, let me just write this all together. When I apply the second derivative, I missed a factor of 1/2 somewhere, but OK. So this is the story at the end of the day, up to possible factors of 1/2 that I goofed up. So this piece corresponds to the dw d phi squared part. And this is a scalar potential. And this piece gives me a mass for psi plus the Yukawa coupling. And the thing that is related by supersymmetry is, first of all, I see that when I square this, I get a scalar mass of m squared. When I square this, I get a fermion mass of m. And the normalization with the 1/2 gives me that this is the physical mass of the vowel fermion. This is the physical mass of the complex scalar. So the masses match up. But I also see that supersymmetry relates the interactions. So for example, this is going to give me a cubic interaction and a quartic interaction of phi. It's controlled by the value of m and lambda. This piece is going to give me a Yukawa interaction that's controlled by lambda. And this is exactly the same lambda that appears here. So this formulation of interactions in terms of superpotential enforces supersymmetry in the sense that it turns out, and this is somewhat non-trivial, that these interactions are all consistent, are all invariant under supersymmetry transformations. So if you write supersymmetry transformations in terms of changes in the fields, as I just sketch out schematically over here, it's not at all obvious that these interaction terms are going to be invariant. But it turns out that as long as you formulate it in terms of a superpotential, you're guaranteed invariance under supersymmetry. OK, so this is how you deal with chiral supermultiplets and their interactions. The next kind of field I want to talk about for connecting with a standard model are vector fields.
So why we have to formulate the superpotential in terms of the multiplets rather than directly in terms of the complex scalar, since you need to do the derivative and evaluate it at the complex scalar?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. What's your question?
Also, why the superpotential have to be formulated in terms of the multiplet rather than directly in terms of the complex scalar?
There's a more formal way in which the superpotential is better thought of as being a function of the whole chiral multiplet. But you're right. If you wanted to, at this level, you could formulate everything in terms of just a function of a scalar component. But it ends up being equivalent, but there's a sense in which this ends up being useful beyond what I'm introducing.
So far, I cannot see why the oscillator is built to find a chiral multiplet. Why do
you
need that here?
OK, so at this level, you don't need it. But at the level of actually writing out the supersymmetry transformations, it ends up, if you want them to come out in a nice way, a nice linear way, you want the auxiliary field. So at this level, it doesn't necessarily help. But I want to introduce it so you're familiar with it if you see supersymmetry transformations down the road in a more formal way. You'll see how the F term's coming. OK, so before I wrap up, I just want to talk briefly about vector supermultiplets. And the vector supermultiplet is the minimal way in which I can get vector superfields. Or vector fields, which I'm also going to want to connect with the standard model. And the minimal formulation of this has three sets of components. I have a vial fermion. I have an AMU field. And then I have a so-called auxiliary D field. OK, and I should say that I have this. And when I say this, I also secretly have its complex conjugate lambda bar.
Is the observability also the complex scalar?
So the A and the D are real scalars, or they're real valued. And the minimal action for this turns out to be E4x, lambda bar, lambda, mu, plus 1/2 d squared. And again, this isn't very exciting. I just have some vowel fermion. I have some vector field f mu nu, and I have some d stuff here. So if I count degrees of freedom, before I apply the equations of motion, the a mu has 3 independent degrees of freedom. The d has 1. And I have 4 fermionic degrees of freedom for the lambdas. So before applying the equations of motion, I have 4 and 4. And this is the off-shell story. On shell, I have 2 fermionic degrees of freedom. I have a fermion plus its antiparticle. Those are the 2 physical excitations. The D field turns out to drop out. If I apply the equation of motion, I just get D equals to 0. And then if I look at this, this ends up being a massless vector field, which has a built-in gauge invariance, which means that there are only 2 physical degrees of freedom, 2 polarizations. So on shell and off shell, we see that everything matches up. And we're going to want to take the story and add interactions. So there are 2 ways to add interactions. At this level, this just describes an abelian gauge theory and a corresponding massless vowel fermion with no gauge charge and then a non-dynamical D term. So the 2 ways in which I can add interactions are I can upgrade the story such that instead of corresponding to an abelian gauge field, this would be a non-abelian gauge field. And that would give me self-interactions between the vectors. The second way I can upgrade this is to connect with matter fields. So I could think of this as a U1 gauge theory connecting up to matter that's charged under the gauge theory. So I'm going to start off by connecting to the charged matter, and I'll come back tomorrow and talk about connecting to the non-abelian story. Okay. So to connect to the non-abelian story, we're going to take this and we're going to add a pair of chiral supermultiplets that are charged with charges under the U1. So we're going to add to the action the chiral supermultiplet. And it turns out that the supersymmetrization of the interaction is that I just replace the derivatives I had up here by covariant derivatives. F dagger F. But it turns out that I'm going to need one more piece. And supersymmetry invariance, which now has, I've now introduced an interaction between the vector field and the matter fields. So this d mu is going to be del mu plus I g q a mu, where a mu is the vector field going into here, g is the gauge coupling, and q is the effective charge of the state. To get supersymmetry invariance, it turns out that I need to add an extra piece. And that extra piece turns out to be a root 2 g phi dagger. Sorry, my phis end up looking like q's. Oops. Get this right. Phi dagger psi lambda. Minus root 2 g lambda bar psi bar phi times q minus g q phi squared d. Then close the bracket. Okay, so it turns out that if I want to extend this theory to include non-trivial couplings to matter fields, I do the usual thing. I take my matter fields, and I give them covariant derivatives. So this shouldn't be surprising. But it turns out that supersymmetry requires one set of additional pieces. And the set of additional pieces has the form of charged matter, fermion superpartner of the vector field. And same over here. And finally, this piece gives me a part of the vector field with charged matter. So the form of all these interactions, if I think about my original gauge interaction, let's say with fermions, is going to look like this. From this is the psi bar I. This is the interaction I get from that with, let's say, the fermion. I get a similar interaction with the scalar through here. This thing has the form of a, here's a phi, here's a psi, and here's a lambda. Connecting like that. So this would be a psi, this would be a psi. This piece, if you like, corresponds to a supersymmetrization of this, in the sense that here I have two matter fields connecting to the vector field. And what's happened here is I've replaced two of these legs by superpartners. So here I've replaced the psi by superpartner phi, and I've replaced A by superpartner lambda. And the same story goes for this. This is just a complex conjugate. And finally, this piece, if you like, corresponds to a D field with two phi legs, like so. So we'll see tomorrow that this piece, like I did before, I can now apply the equation of motion for D. And when I apply the equation of motion for D, combining this with this, I'm going to get a scalar self interaction left over from the gauge interaction with strength proportional to the gauge coupling. So this is a story for connecting an abelian gauge field to matter fields. And tomorrow we'll come back and talk about non-abelian vector fields and non-abelian vector supermultiplets connecting with matter fields. So yeah, just in passing, this is what we call a vector supermultiplet. Okay. So in the tutorial, you'll get some practice working with these things, and I think some more in the homework. So again, I better wrap it up there. If you have questions, come ask me, and I guess otherwise I'll see you tomorrow.